sorry for the gaveling. I hope that wasn't bringing back any memories among people.
I remember when I had a gavel.
That was probably a fond memory for you, Representative Borkelson. Well, anyway, I call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the March 8th meeting. Lead Torkelson, you reviewed the minutes? Would you, you know, just to bring back memories of when you had that gavel, if you want to make a motion here?
Chair, you know, when I was chair of transportation, I always called on a DFL member of the committee to approve the minutes. So this is more happy memories. I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson has moved approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. First bill on the agenda is House File 2746. Representative Hicks, I think I saw you over there. So I will move that House File 2746 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. You can take a minute to get settled. And when you're ready, just please describe your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill today. This bill is money that would be distributed for accessibility at polling locations. People with disabilities have the right and the desire to vote. Individuals with disabilities are very affected by a lot of the things that occur in this chamber and in other chambers. And so ensuring that they have equal access to polling locations is really important. Similar grants like this have occurred in the past, and counties have indicated that additional funds and support is needed to ensure that all polling locations are accessible. So that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I have Nicole Freeman has signed up to testify. Welcome to the committee. Please, when you've had a seat, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of Secretary of State. My testimony is pretty brief this morning. Just wanted to lend support and thank Representative Hicks for bringing this bill. As she mentioned, counties have let us know that they have equipment as well as other pieces such as ramps and accessible voting booths that are reaching their end of life. And at a countywide level, needing to replace those is a significant chunk of money. And so they have indicated that if there is a desire for state or even federal help, as in the past, that they would be supportive of that. So happy to answer any questions that members might have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. Lead Torkelson? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Davis, did you have your hand up? Oh, okay.
All right.
Lead Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author or to the testifier. First, aren't these facilities subject to ADA?
Sure.
Nicole Freeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Lead Torkelson. So, yes, they are subject to ADA. In my experience and from hearing from counties and cities, what these grants have typically been used for before are enhancements to restrooms, as well as enhancements to or additions, I guess, to make non-primary doors accessible. So sometimes if you're, you know, voting at a school, for example, that's an older location, the main doors are ADA accessible. But if you're off in one of the wings of a school, for example, sometimes there's a non-primary door that's much closer with parking available much closer. That would be more convenient for voters of all abilities to use. But they may need to upgrade a door handle or add a add an automatic door opener to that door, depending on the circumstance. And so sometimes those pieces are used for that. Additionally, there's ramps, portable ramps that they'll use for those non-primary doors to allow folks easier access. So there isn't so much, you know, walking through a whole school building if you could park on one of the ends and just go in right there where that voting location may be.
And
Representative Hicks.
Also, ADA is one of those things that people like to talk about all the time as being an unfunded mandate. So there isn't funds to ensure that locations are ADA compliant. And the ADA actually has some grandfather clauses that are super, in my opinion, ableist, but we can have that conversation a different day about buildings that are allowed to, like, get away with certain pieces because of the years they were built and different components. And so really the point of this money is to make sure that our counties aren't bearing the financial costs of ensuring all voters can vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Freeman, you referenced school buildings, and the bill specifically states municipalities and counties. Can they spend their money on school buildings?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. So dollars could be used to enhance, the way that I read the bill at least, the dollars could be used to enhance any polling location. So if a school is being used as a polling location, a church, for example, would be another example. And I know there's a number of older buildings across the state that are used as polling locations. In addition to, it's not often that you have to change polling locations, but for various reasons, there are times where municipalities have to select new polling locations. So then identifying a building that meets, you know, all of the requirements for space and other needs, as well as meets all the accessibility requirements. Sometimes there are small changes that need to be made to a building to make it accessible.
Representative Ferguson?
Do you mind, Mr. Chair, if I continue?
You may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So isn't this generally the responsibility of the counties? And how did you arrive at this amount of money, and is it going to be enough? Is it going to be too much? Seems to me $500,000 can be spent very quickly depending on the situation.
Representative Hicks?
Yes, thank you so much for the question. The amount of money was decided based on, there have been previous grants before, and based on what usage was, this seemed like a fair amount. Now, to be fair, there may be things that we haven't considered here, and like my testifier spoke to, a lot of the accessible voting booths are starting to need to be updated. They are out of their life, for use of a better word, because it's more than just the physical accessibility. When people think about accessibility, they immediately go to things like ramps and door handles and that kind of stuff, which is absolutely appropriate and relevant. But the parts that we don't talk about are like, for individuals that maybe blind or have other sort of, can't reach the typical voting counter and need a lower voting counter or need different accommodations to be able to read their ballot or to access their ballot or to flip over their ballot, right? There's all of these other kind of accommodations that are so important. And so the number was based on previous usage and an estimate. The other thing that I just sort of want to mention that sometimes gets lost in translation when we're talking about accessibility is that disability is the great equalizer. You can never need an accessibility component to vote or do anything for your entire life, and then you suffer a stroke, and now half of your body no longer works the way you want it to work, and your dominant hand is no longer as strong, and your vision in your right eye is no longer as sharp. And now all of a sudden you need accommodations, and the shock that typically is to folks when they realize how inaccessible things that they consider just every day have become is one of the reasons that there's been a little bit more focus on ensuring accessibility in all spaces, but particularly around voting. And so this is really designed to make sure that counties have the funds they need to ensure that all of their voters, including those with disabilities, can vote.
Maybe final question, would like to get to the other bills on the agenda too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm getting there. Just a better explanation of just how this program might work. Apparently it's been done in the past. Are the grants limited in size, or could one county suck up the entire $500,000 if they get their application in first? How will this operate?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Twickelson. So OSS anticipates that it would operate similar to other grants, and so there would be a pro rata amount determined based on based on the applications. Generally, there's a consultation with municipalities and counties over what the needs are, and then the grant program is more fleshed out.
One short final question. Is cost share part of this approach? Does the county have to contribute a percentage, or is it full funding?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Lee Torkelson. The way that the bill reads, it doesn't require that. So I would say the way the bill reads, it doesn't require that. I think, but oftentimes the what we find with our grant applications is that the need exceeds the funds that we have available to give out, and so by default there would be that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems that we're state's trying to take over county responsibilities here, and I question whether this is carefully constructed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no additional member questions, any closing remarks, Representative Hicks?
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee, and thank you for the dialogue today. It is important that we recognize that people with disabilities have the desire and the right to vote, just like other citizens, and ensuring that our counties have the support they need to ensure that all of their citizens can vote is an important part of our role here at the legislature. So thank you so much for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I renew the motion that House File 2746 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Next on the agenda is House File 2337. Vice Chair Greenman, I'll give you when you are settled up there, I think you would like to move that House File 2337 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Is that your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Thanks. Did you want to move the A2 amendment at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like to hear it.
Is there any discussion to the A2 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like. So, Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2337 as amended, a bill that will increase the transparency of independent political spending to influence our vote as we approach the election. This bill does that by adopting the electioneering communication standard that's now been law since 2002 at the federal level and that more than 25 states have adopted since. As anyone who's turned on the TV or radio in the months before an election can tell you, probably all of us, some of us have been the target of it, the airwaves have been filled with political advertisements targeting candidates, some of them negative and nasty, with the goal of influencing the electorate before an election. Some of these ads will explicitly tell you who to vote for or against, while others directly targeting candidates with attacks or praise on hot-button issues sure to resonate with voters. Under current Minnesota law, voters don't know who's behind these ads that run right before the elections. The secret spending means that voters don't know what interests are trying to influence their vote and can't assess the credibility of the ads. As we've heard in committee many times this year, Minnesota's transparency and disclosure laws, as they relate to independent expenditures, have not kept up with this problem and the explosion of outside spending that's fueling it. One area that this is especially true is in this strategic issue advocacy, advertising targeting voters of candidates right before an election. While these independent ads may not mention the upcoming election, the timing, the targeting, and the proximity of the election ensure that they will have an impact on voters as they cast their vote. And voters have a right to know who are behind these ads. They have a right to know who's trying to influence their vote and who is working to influence our government. Moreover, these secret spenders oftentimes run ads that are deliberately misleading and inflammatory. Voters need to know who are behind them, who's funding them, so that they can weigh the credibility of the messages that are being delivered and cast an informed vote. This bill provides transparency by closing a dark money loophole, requiring the disclosure of the secret spending on TV and radio ads that run right before the elections. And while we like to think that Minnesota is always above the curve, ahead of the curve, on this, we are behind the times. Two decades ago, the federal government adopted a standard to deal with electioneering communications like these. And since then, 25 states have adopted standards, many going way well beyond what the federal standard and what is in this bill, some which include digital mail. This just focuses on TV and radio. So here's how the bill works. We are adopting the tried and true federal standard. And what this does is it defines electioneering communications and then adds reporting requirements for this type of communications. The provision applies to communications that are broadcast TV or radio or cable ads, clearly identify a candidate, are publicly distributed to that candidate's relevant electorate, and are made within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election. The policy requires that if you spend more than $10,000 in aggregate on these electioneering communications, then you have to report to the Campaign Finance Board which candidates you're targeting, who bought, paid for, and is responsible for the ads, and which big contributors over $1,000 have been funding the communications. It requires you disclose the details of the ads, including when it was purchased and the amount that was spent on it. Under the current law, political funds that are doing express advocacy are already required to report and register their independent expenditures. What this bill is meant to do is deal with the type of ads that appear outside that appear out of nowhere, often on the eve of an election, where the secret sources of spending are otherwise unknown and are not being registered or reported within our current campaign finance structure. Additionally, with this amendment, the bill provides the Campaign Finance Board with the tools to ensure that large political spenders are complying with this reporting provision and with our existing campaign finance reporting provisions by increasing the penalties for failing to report if the aggregate expenditures are more than $25,000 for that reporting period, and allowing the Campaign Finance Board to double the penalties for individuals or associations who repeatedly fail to file their reports on time. This bill will ensure that voters know who is spending on election eve ads and who is trying to influence their vote. We know Minnesotans want real transparency about who's spending money in our elections. They want to know that it's their voice, their informed vote, that is driving our democracy and the decisions that are governing our state. This will mean more government accountability, less influence of wealthy special interests, and less political corruption. This is a way to establish and provide that transparency to Minnesota voters. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I have one testifier who signed up to, that is Sharon Tornes. Welcome to the committee. Once you've arrived, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Tornes, and I'm a member of the Legislative Committee of Clean Elections Minnesota, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that seeks an inclusive and healthy democracy for our state. I'm here to testify in support of House File 2337. I want to thank Representative Greenman for introducing this bill. It's a bill that would empower voters by informing them who is paying for the ads that have been crafted in order to persuade them to support or oppose an issue or a ballot initiative, and also to contact elected officials. This bill does not in any way regulate the content of issue ads. First Amendment rights are not affected in this. The fact that it is modeled on a federal law enacted in 2002, which was not impacted at all by the Citizens United decision with its strong First Amendment endorsement. This simply requires disclosure to the State Campaign Finance Board as to who is paying for these ads. Broadcast media has a major influence on elections and ballot initiatives. It can enlighten and inform voters, or it can confuse them by using misleading facts or by spreading outright disinformation. While expenditures for ads that expressly advocate for candidates by name are required to be reported, issue ads are not. Groups that pay for these ads operate in near secrecy. Nevertheless, it's abundantly clear that these ads are made to influence the outcome of elections, and they should be treated as such. The new law would require groups that pay for radio or TV ads in Minnesota that reach 10,000 viewers or more to report issue ads to the Campaign Finance Board. These ads can make or break an election or ballot initiative. Voters deserve and need to know who is paying for ads to assist them in making decisions. We urge your support for HF 2337. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Sharon Tornos. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Lee Torkelson, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the author. So first, can you kind of explain the term? What's the difference between an electioneering ad and any other political ad?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson. And I think that what that is getting at is currently under Minnesota law, an independent expenditure, in order to file and register as an independent expenditure, it's express advocacy. And we've talked about express advocacy, which is a communication that is pretty explicit, either directly by saying the magic words or the conversation we've been having about express advocacy, the functional equivalent of that. But so it references an election. It's very clear. When we're talking about electioneering communication, we're talking about it matters that there's a proximity to an election. So an issue ad that targets, for instance, the governor, the night before an election or a week before the election may hit voters and probably does differently than it would if it was in January of 2023. And so what we're really talking about is there's a set of ads that move beyond the express advocacy, but because of their proximity to the election, because of their targeting of the electorate, it's an objective standard that says this is likely to influence voters, and voters have the right to know who's spending them and what the campaigns or what the who the contributors are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So an election ad becomes an electioneering ad when it reaches that window of time?
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there are ads that that don't reference an election that may, if they're a year before an election, the voters may be paying attention to the issue, but when it gets close to an election, what it is clearly trying to do and what the reason that the BICRA passed it in 2002 is that what we're seeing is a lot of times hard-hitting issue ads that pop up right before the election that are undisclosed, that because of their impact on, because of their targeting of the electorate, because of their clearly targeting of candidates, and because of the timing, have an impact on voters, and we want to make sure voters know who is spending that money so they can assess the credibility of the ads.
Vice Chair Greenman, maybe you could tell us what BICRA is.
Thank you. BICRA was the bill passed in 2002. It's a federal law. It's the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. I believe I have the, looking at Matt Gearing. Right, but it was passed in 2002, and the electioneering provision that exists today is modeled on that bill, or that we're trying to pass today.
Thank you. Felt like I was back in Health and Human Services for a second.
Apologies.
Representative Torkelson.
That's a bad memory, Mr. Sorry. So, you know, just trying to focus on this term electioneering and understanding what it really means. So there certainly are ads that can run any time that try to define candidates. We've seen this when candidates have just announced their intention to run for office. We've seen ads pop up from various sources that try to define the candidate before they have a chance to define themselves. But they're well outside of this 60-day window that you're talking about. So I'm still trying to figure out what, you know, electioneering is a term to me that it has negative connotations. But these are ads, we have these sorts of ads happening all the time, potentially.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lee Torkelson. And I agree with you. I think that in most cases, these issue ads are strategically placed and intentionally intended to inflect the election. I think what this is really sort of a compromise. It might be under-inclusive, to your point. It's possible that, and I think to your point of there's lots of strategic issue ads that are intended to influence voters. What this does is apply an objective standard that says, as we get close to the election, it is very important that voters know where these ads are coming from. If they're not an independent expenditure that are already required to be disclosed and reported. 60 days before an election, if you're going to spend more than $10,000 on broadcast ads targeting a candidate to their electorate, voters deserve the right to know. I'm happy to talk about whether we should make that a bigger window, but right now, and I think that the reason that you'll see sort of the structure of the bill and focusing on a broader set of communications as you get closer to the election is the general acknowledgement that it has a different impact. It hits voters different when they, in many cases, already have their ballot potentially in front of them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you've mentioned that it hits voters differently. It certainly hits different organizations differently too, depending on their base of contributors. But I'm going to switch now to this question of the window. You've talked about these 60 days before the election, but the bill has a much broader impact than that, because you mentioned other primaries and caucuses. And so during an election year, this would delve deep into the legislative session. And should we have special sessions as we approach, as we have had sometimes, hopefully never again, but as we approach the election season, you could very well have a special session within that time frame. You could have bills before the governor that are awaiting a signature, that legitimate issue ads would be presented that really are not focused on the election but could be impacted by your legislation. So can you talk a little bit about this? You know, really the window is much broader than the 60 days just before the election and the complications of special sessions.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lee Torkelson. And I appreciate the conversation with yesterday about it and the thoughtfulness, because I think that really matters. I think when we talk about the window, right, and we talk about voters, as voters are getting ready to cast a ballot at their convention or cast a ballot in a primary, whether or not we are in the legislature, frankly, their mind is on that election. And so as an objective standard, I think what this bill does is it does not in any way prevent any of that issue advertising. It does not get in the way of that. All it says is if you are going to run a broadcast ad, a cable ad, a radio ad over $10,000 in aggregate, that you have to tell voters who is behind those ads and when and who they're targeting. And so I think that to your point, there is lots of legitimate issue ads, and some folks have the resources to try to go directly to voters and do issue ads, and nothing in this bill prevents that from happening. What it does say is if we're getting close to an election, voters have the ability, should have the ability to know who's trying to influence their vote, whether or not we are in unending special session or regular session in an election year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this needs some more discussion and work, but I will not take it any further this morning. What is the motion on this bill?
It is being referred to the Judiciary Committee.
And what's it? Any? Can I ask you what its future is after that?
You can ask. I don't know that I know 100% sure. It's possible it could show up in an omnibus bill I don't know that it would travel separately, but I guess I don't know for sure that it wouldn't either. So, I don't know. Did you have thoughts about that point, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it has to go to Judiciary because of civil fines and fees. I have not thought about its future more than that. But Representative Torkelson, I have appreciated our conversation, and we should keep talking.
All right. Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Greenman. You know, this bill, and I've carried bills similar to this for years now, and the one term that we often use to refer to this type of law, in all honesty, is a sunshine law. And I love that term because that's exactly what it does. It spreads a little bit of sunshine so that folks can actually see who's attempting to influence their vote. And as we've talked about here, voters not only want to know, they have a right to know who's influencing their vote. And the fact that we have federal legislation that already starts to go down that road, it speaks a lot, considering that it's hard to get anything through Congress these days, right? But I think the point is that it provides a consistent set of rules of the road, right? One that everyone can follow, so that we know who is attempting to influence those votes. This is literally a common sense measure. It is not stopping or restricting any form of speech. It is simply allowing voters a little bit of sunshine and hopefully a little disinfectant to be able to see who's actually influencing their vote. It is what voters are asking for. It is what voters want to know. And it just makes sense. So I thank you for bringing the bill forward, and I look forward to voting yes.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any additional member discussion? Representative Ferkelson?
Really just a statement, Mr. Chair. You know, we're talking about some fairly complicated issues here regarding this and express advocacy, and getting a thorough understanding of how these two changes interact and how it affects our systems, I think is important. I'm not going to go there this morning, but I hope that as we proceed with this committee that we delve into the details of these changes and how they interact before we solidify our position.
Thank you.
We're going to be bipartisan, right, Mr. Yeah. Chair?
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I do appreciate the insightful questions you asked. Not seeing any additional member discussion. Representative Greenman, any closing remarks?
No, Mr. Chair, I would just say I do appreciate the discussion, and I think figuring this out, figuring out how we ensure that we're protecting our elections by ensuring that voters know who's spending and what they're trying to, who they're trying to influence is really important. I will save my Justice Scalia quote for the floor, but know that he was a big advocate for transparency and disclosure, and you will rarely hear me cite Justice Scalia. So, but I will say that for the floor, and look forward to continued conversations. And with that, I'd ask for your support.
Sure, thank you. So, Representative Greenman renews the motion that House File 2337, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Coulter, we have House File 1776. Representative Coulter, would you like to move that House File 1776 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Okay, thank you. There is an A1 amendment. I think, I believe that is your amendment, right, Representative Coulter?
That's correct.
Would you, this one I know does make a somewhat more substantive change that was initially made in the other body, which we're not supposed to talk about, but so just since it's a little bit of a more substantive change, do you want to describe the A1 amendment for members?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does make a little more, it's more than a little more than a technical amendment, I would say. Part of it is technical, just sort of cleaning up language around individual party units. Section 9 repeals the section of statute that is was sort of rendered moot by a court decision related to caucus participation. So that is sort of the essence of the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. To your bill, Representative Coulter, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1776 is a bill that I sort of teased in admittedly a rather tacky way previously, but I do hope that doesn't distract from what I think is actually a fairly legitimate issue. And I should also state up front that the genesis of this bill actually came from the introductory presentation that we had from the Campaign Finance Board. So now we can all say that something actually came out of one of the intro presentations that we had in committee. So I'm sure you all know this already, but here in Minnesota, anyone who is a lobbyist is required to register with the Campaign Finance Board and fulfill other sort of various requisite requirements in statute. And there are basically two activities that can trigger that requirement to register as a lobbyist: making more than $3,000 in any year, or spending more than $250 in any year attempting to influence legislative or official action by communicating or urging others to communicate with public officials or local officials of a metropolitan governmental unit, which is defined in statute as any of the seven metro area counties or any city in the seven-county metro area with a population of more than $50,000. $50,000. I was in finance committee late last night. 50,000 people is obviously what I meant to say there. So in essence, what that means is if I make $3,001 lobbying the state, I have to register as a lobbyist. If I make $3,001 lobbying the city council in my hometown of Bloomington, I have to register as a lobbyist. But if I head just a little ways northeast of here and lobby, say, the city council in Maplewood, or if I lobby the city council in Rochester, or if I lobby county boards in St. Louis or Olmsted or Watonwan or Couchiching counties, for example, I don't. We all know that state dollars are invested all over the state, and local communities are very often involved in decision-making. So I think as a state legislature, I think we have a fiduciary responsibility to know who is lobbying local officials anywhere in the state. More fundamentally, though, we require lobbyist registration because we value transparency and responsibility. I think we all believe that Minnesotans have a right to know who is lobbying their officials at the state level and who is paying those lobbyists to do that work. But when it comes to local officials, the folks in charge of zoning ordinances, tax increment financing, utilities maintenance, and so on, we only extend that transparency up to a point. Transparency and accountability are important for every level of government, regardless of the number of people who live there. And I think that's something that we can all agree on. And House File 1776 would show that we mean that. So at this point, I would like to turn things over to my testifier, Mary Supple. Mary is the mayor of Richfield. And I do just want to state before she speaks that while her status as a local public official is, of course, relevant to this discussion, she is not here in her capacity as mayor of Richfield. This is not something that has been approved as a legislative priority by the City Council of Richfield or the city government of Richfield. She is here by virtue of her status as a public official, not as a representative of the city of Richfield. I just want to make that sort of explicit for folks. So with that, with the chair's permission, I can turn things over to Mayor Supple.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and members of the House Elections, Finance, and Policy Committee for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 1776. My name is Mary Supple. I am the proud mayor of the city of Richfield. As Representative Coulter mentioned, I'm here speaking as an individual, as our city has not considered the bill and does not have a position on it. First and foremost, transparency is a cornerstone of good government. When I taught middle school social studies, we emphasized the importance of participating in government and that the state's lawmaking took place in the public square. Open meetings, civil discussions, and transparency were part of what made good government in Minnesota. House File 1776 adds to that transparency. Richfield has less than 50,000 residents, but it is still important for my constituents to know who is lobbying their elected officials. That is why I support this bill. Population size should not determine transparency. Expanding lobbyist registration to all political subdivisions supports good government. When a new project or ordinance comes before our city council, I am frequently asked who benefits from the possible outcomes and who is in support of the proposal. I think that residents would appreciate knowing who is getting paid to lobby us. Population size should not affect accountability. Thank you for your time and listening to my testimony in support of House File 1776.
Thank you for your testimony, Mayor Supple. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to be hogging the mic this morning.
Fine.
I think, is Mr. Sigurdsson still in the room? I saw he came in earlier. I think he might be able to answer my first question as far as the impact on the campaign finance board of these potential changes.
Sure. Proceed with your question.
Mr. Sigurdsson, how will this bill impact the campaign finance board?
So, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and then respond to the question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jeff Sigurdson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. Representative Torkelson, I did do a fiscal note. We would need a staff addition of one individual to deal with the expansion of member of cities and counties, school districts, townships that it's in this legislation.
Thank you. And just for members' knowledge, the fiscal note is in our packet. I think there's a late handout. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Do you see any issues accommodating these changes within the Campaign Finance Board?
Director Sigurdson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, to me the issue isn't so much the registration or reporting. I mean, that's simply a matter of more as opposed to a different, to a different procedure. I think the challenge for staff would be under this provision or under this legislation, the gift prohibition that exists between lobbyists and public officials would then be expanded to those local officials. That doesn't change the nature of the support that we provide individuals who are covered by the gift prohibition, but it does, in my mind, create a rather large outreach program to try to reach the additional 800-plus cities that are now going to be under this legislation, the 80 counties that are now going to be under this legislation, and make sure that they're aware of that set of regulations so that we don't have violations. So basically it becomes an educational issue and an outreach issue. The additional registrations, I'm estimating that we'll probably have between 550 and 600 additional lobbyists registered in the state under this legislation. Again, I believe we can handle that relatively easily, but supporting the individuals on the other side, the local officials who will be covered by the lobbying legislation is something that we'll need the additional individual for.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdson. To the author, then, this really is changing the scope of reporting dramatically and affecting some very relatively small populations or units of government. I want to congratulate you on the proper pronunciation of Watonwan. It happens to be my home county, not in my district, however. Did you consider possibly, I realize there are some large cities that are not included in the seven-county metropolitan area that would be subject to this reporting HIP if they were in the seven-county. Did you consider just reaching more of a practical approach to this where you would just incorporate those larger cities rather than all of our counties, no matter what their size?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson. Part of the reason I know how to pronounce Watonwan is that my mom grew up in Gibbon, not too far from there. But, to your specific question, and I should state as well that I did, before the bill was introduced, I did reach out to the League of Minnesota Cities, and they did not express any particular concerns with the legislation. And that was a thought that occurred to me as well, to maybe only extend it to certain larger cities or counties. There were a couple of reasons that I didn't pursue that approach. Primarily, as I said, sort of to my mind, transparency is transparency, regardless of population size. We make city councils and county boards follow open meeting law, for example, regardless of population. And I think that to me is sort of the overriding concern. And I just forgot the second point that I was about to make. My apologies.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I think you covered it, Representative Coulter. May I turn my line of questioning over to her? I don't need to turn it over. I'm done for the moment.
Sure. Representative Alden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. Can you further explain a little bit about this bill, that it's removing the requirement that eligible voters are participating in the caucus process, and then explain if we're allowing people who are not eligible to vote why they would be participating in the caucus process, which ultimately is, producing the candidate that's going to run. And in a climate right now of, just wanting to make sure that we have full transparency of everything that's going on, I'm not able to really understand why we would be stripping out that.
Representative Poulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, and thank you, Representative Altner, for the question. So, as I alluded to earlier, this particular change comes about largely by virtue of a court ruling that essentially made that particular section of statute relating to caucus participation moot. And the court case was Minnesota DFL versus and McCourt versus Simon. They were combined into one case. And the particular line here that I would say sort of that distills that is, this is from the court ruling. It says, in sum, we conclude that by the plain language of the statutes, the criminal penalties in the election eligibility statute and the unlawful voting statute do not apply to the caucus eligibility statute. In essence, the court stated that those are sort of separate issues. And I think the sort of the overall reasoning was laid out earlier in the court ruling. And it, you know, I think I'm assuming every one of us on this committee has been to precinct caucuses at least once. But caucuses really, I mean, they serve the purpose of eventually leading to a political endorsement or a political party endorsement, I should say. But they do more than that as well. And the court ruling specifically states that a caucus is defined as, quote, a meeting of the local members of a political party, especially to select delegates to a convention or register preferences for a candidate running for office, whereas an election is defined as the act or process of electing someone to fill an office or position. So caucuses, you know, they have a broader purpose. You know, folks gather in a room and they elect delegates to county or organizing unit conventions, but they also debate platform resolutions and elect local party officers and so on. So caucuses have sort of a broader purpose than that. And so, in essence, the court's determination lines up with, I would say, with my thinking and sort of generally how caucuses have proceeded, which is that caucuses are a party-run affair. They are not elections in the same way that we think of the government-run elections that we use to elect officials. So that was the purpose in that particular section of the amendment.
Representative Altenburg, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that leaves a lot of gray area. I'm not sure if this is necessary language to have in this bill. I know you're referencing a court document, and I feel like this has happened before where I ask a valid question and then we get referenced back to some court proceedings that may or may not. I'm just not sure. It really is making this very gray area, and I guess my suggestion would be to strip that out. Right now, we have to build confidence in our elections. This is not building confidence in the elections, and I just really would like us to do this in a bipartisan way.
Thank you, Representative Altenburg. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's kind of where I was going with this. And I guess you read through the bill and you read through the amendment, and it makes no mention of caucus participation or anything. The only mention is in the repealer referencing a statute.
Mm-hmm.
Just seems like that was hidden in there. I don't understand why, what caucus participation has to do with campaign finance and public disclosure board information. So I guess back to what Representative Altendorf said is, you know, that free and fair elections and clear, you know, we're in caucuses, we do run for delegates. We do vote for the selection of a candidate to run for office. I failed to see, again, where this particular repealer fits into this bill. I guess maybe it's too early in the morning for my mind to work like that. But also at the same time, to allow people that are ineligible to vote, not residents possibly even, to participate in caucuses, I don't understand the need for it and why we would be hiding it into a little repealer in this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bliss. I did make certain that Representative Coulter explained this was part of the amendment that was adopted earlier, so I made sure he explained it because it is a more substantive change. And it was done initially in the other body, and I don't always try to divine their meeting. I mean, you might, of what they do over there, you might have better luck trying to divine meaning from chicken entrails than what happens in the other body. But
there may be a little science in that, too, Mr.
I don't know. Representative Coulter, did you have any response?
You know, I think you covered it, and I guess I would just again, you know, refer to the fact that, you know, as I said, caucuses are party-run, excuse me, party-run affairs. And I think, you know, we can sort of talk about what guardrails may need to be put on that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think my sort of general outlook is to give the parties leeway in sort of determining who participates in a party-run process. And, you know, yes, caucuses do, if you continue the process through to your county or organizing unit convention, may lead to an endorsement of a candidate. But we all know that primaries actually determine who is on the ballot. And this does not, again, I want to be very clear, this does not change anything with regards to who is eligible to vote. This solely relates to caucus participation. So it's entirely separate from, as I said, the actual electing of public officials.
Representative Bliss.
Just one follow-up. So it's up to the party unit, so the Republican Party or the Democrat Party can say, we only want people that have voted in the, basically following the law as it is currently. There's no law against following what's currently in law.
Representative Coulter?
If I understand your question correctly, and it's pretty early for me too, admittedly, I would say the answer is yes, that what this would do is leave the decision of, and I'm admittedly not familiar with the full extent of statute. There may be something else with regards to that in statute that I'm not aware of. But insofar as I'm aware, this would leave that call up to the individual political parties. So the DFL, Republican Party, the Legal Marijuana Now Party, they could set essentially their rules for who participates in their processes.
Any additional member discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author of the bill, there's a change in language in the amendment on lines 1.6 to 1.8 that seems to expand the definition of party organization to be determined really by the party itself. Can you illuminate me as to the purpose of this change in language?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To my understanding, this really is, so my understanding is that this is more just a technical cleanup to sort of be more of a catch-all rather than the sort of specific list of, you know, individual party units. I know, for example, you know, that there are party units that may represent only a portion of a legislative district within one county, as an example, that would, to my guess, be sort of an example of where it might be helpful rather than have a specific list to just say that the chairs of the parties are able to sort of certify and define what their local party units are.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my next question then is for Mr. Sigurdsson, as long as he's at the table. How would this change in language impact organizations that are qualify for the current PCR program or other potential dollar programs?
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, perhaps just a little bit of background too. This issue came up through redistricting. In some cases, political parties were interested because of, administrative need of interested in the possibility of combining counties. In other words, saying that this is the DFL for X county and X county. And the board didn't believe that the current statute allowed for that. And so this is providing greater flexibility to combine cities, combine legislative districts, combine counties in terms of identifying what the party unit is. It also opens up the possibility for both parties to look at organizations which are currently registered with the board as a political committee, but which are clearly recognized by the party as a caucus. For example, both the Republican Party and the DFL Party have a Veterans Caucus. They have a Seniors Caucus. They have other caucuses which are recognized by the party, but which cannot be registered as a political party with us because they don't meet this definition. This would allow the chairs to increase the number of entities which are recognized party units, which then, I'm finally getting to your question, would allow them to change their registration to become party units, which means that they would be issued be able to issue political contribution refunds as a political party unit. Further, their contributions would then count against the party unit limit as opposed to the political committee limit. So it would have that impact, but in terms of the board's administration, it's merely changing the type of registration that we provide.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but that designation would be completely in the power of the political party. Is that the way I'm reading it?
Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, sir. Currently, there is a provision that says that on an annual basis, the chair of the political party certifies to us that the political party units that are registered with the board are, in fact, recognized by that party. And if this kind of extends that process and says, all right, you're going to verify the registrations that are with the board, and through that process, you'd also be able to recognize other types of organizations other than what you already see in statute, the basically political and geographic boundaries. They can go beyond that and register and recognize, I should say, other types of party units.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think you answered my next question. So currently, these designations are based on geography or district borders, that sort of thing, and this would open it up to basically issue areas or other potential designations.
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's correct. So both demographics, issue areas, whatever the parties wanted to recognize.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This discussion is great, and it's just opening up more questions. So can you explain to me now, would this open up, you know, the PCR program to all these different groups? Like, there's a lot of smaller groups, right? You know, there's like a disability caucus, veterans caucus, environmental caucus. There's all these different smaller caucuses. So are we opening up this political contribution refund program? And it literally is opening up to all of these.
Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, if the party chair recognizes those entities as political party units, then they would be able to issue PCRs. That's correct.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who to ask this to, but is there a cap on the PCR then? Is there?
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the cap is still on the $50 per individual or $100 per couple, but there isn't a cap on the amount of PCRs that a political party unit or a specific political party unit can issue.
Representative Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, so my question is the cap for the state. There is no cap, so this could greatly increase the PCR program giving to all of these candidates.
Director Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. That's an open appropriation for funding the PCR program. In theory, it could increase the number of PCRs.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think we all can see in this room, this really could open up a big loophole unintended with this PCR program. I mean, this could really open up a lot of smaller caucuses, you know, using this with the uncapped funds at the state level. So this maybe should be something that we look at a lot closer, I would think.
Thank you, Representative Altenberg. Representative Ferguson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it seems like this results in a pretty significant fiscal impact. With many more groups being potentially being eligible for the PCR refund, do we have a fiscal note that reflects that?
Director Sigurdsson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, sir, I did not do a fiscal note for the amendment, no, sir.
Just to respond to that point, I mean, I don't see a huge number of people, you know, I don't see this having a huge impact. I mean, if somebody's inclined to give to the Republican Party as a state versus the Republican Party's Veterans Caucus. I mean, it's still entities, only entities that are recognized by the party chair. So I don't know that there are that many people who would do that, but certainly we can examine the fiscal impact as this goes forward. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly we don't know that it's not either. It seems like there's a pretty significant change involved here that does potentially have significant fiscal impact. This bill has a lot more to it than at first glance, Representative Coulter. I'm wondering how you managed to get such a patriotic number for your bill.
Well, I'm proud to be an American, Representative Torkelson. We're getting a little bit far afield here, but to the point, I only happen to know this because I am also the author of a bill to increase the PCR contribution maximum. And I can tell you, and I don't have the fiscal note obviously right in front of me, it's a relatively small impact because the assumption in, based on the campaign finance board is that increasing that number wouldn't generally encourage more folks to participate in the political contribution refund. It merely it would essentially increase the amount that folks who already do participate are able to get in their refund from the state. So I think that may speak to sort of some of the issues that are raised. But, you know, again, this is going to be laid over. So this is certainly not the last bite at the apple we'd have on this particular language.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to point out that this is getting laid over, so we do have more time to look at this.
So I can't request a roll call, can I, Mr. Chair?
You can request one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill has quite a range to it, given the repealer and these other changes in the amendment. So I look forward to further discussion.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Representative Bonner.
I'll be brief. I did want to just mention or ask Mr. Chair and Mr. Sigurdsson. It kind of was alluded to, but I want to ask it directly, so it's very crisp. This change would not remove the caps that are in place for how much an individual can contribute, correct? It would simply allow a larger array of options for someone to choose if they would like to make a contribution.
I saw Representative Coulter nodding. Do you have additional follow-up?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is yes. As I mentioned, that is a separate bill that I am also the author of, but this bill does not change. Individuals would still get the $50 maximum. Married couples still would get the $100 maximum. That is not affected in this bill.
Representative Bodger.
Thank you. So in other words, we wouldn't necessarily see a flood of new contributions per se, although I think we would all like to think that more individuals at the grassroots level would like to participate in government in whatever form or organization that is. But certainly it would not necessarily make a large dent in that respect in terms of the amount of money that could be spent or not necessarily even the number of folks who would participate, but just give them greater options.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Seeing no additional member discussion, Representative Coulter, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, this bill is being laid over, so we'll certainly have more opportunity to discuss the changes that were made in the amendment. But sort of bringing it back to the original topic of the bill, as I said, transparency is transparency and accountability is accountability. And I think that's true for anyone who's put in a position of public trust. And lack of transparency, lack of accountability are no less harmful when they affect smaller communities or those in greater Minnesota. So that's why I think the language in the original bill, House File 1776, is worth inclusion, and just want to again strongly encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. So with that, Representative Coulter renews the motion that House File 1776, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. You can stay up there, Director Sigurdsson. Give me a moment to assemble my materials and Vice Chair Greenman to take over. I appreciate it. Hello, Madam Chair.
Good. That's the bill on the agenda. 2394. Chair Freiberg, would you like to move your bill?
Sure. I will move that House File 2394 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Freiberg moves that House File 2394 be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Freiberg, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Campaign Finance Board requires disclosure in three areas: lobbying, campaign finance, and economic interest statements. The board periodically evaluates the disclosure required in these programs, looking for current disclosure that does not provide much value to the public, or areas of disclosure that are lacking and need to be improved to build public trust in state government. In the Economic Interests Statement Program, or EIS, the board recommends increasing disclosure in two areas that will help highlight potential conflicts of interest. Generally speaking, this bill requires candidates to disclose potential conflicts that their spouses may have. Property or businesses owned by a spouse certainly have the potential to also create a conflict, and requiring disclosure will increase transparency. There's also a new disclosure requirement for public officials who serve on a government agency that issues contracts, professional licenses, or leases, and the public official or spouse has received a contract, professional license, or lease issued by the agency on which the public official serves. Conversely, the board is recommending decreasing the amount of disclosure required for some public officials because the disclosure currently required does not help highlight potential conflicts of interest and may actually prevent individuals from serving in public office. Specifically, Section 3 reduces the disclosure for soil and water district supervisors and members of watershed management organizations. Jeff Sigurdsson from the Campaign Finance Board is here. I'm not sure if he's here to testify or just to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have in my notes that you're on deck to answer questions, unless you want to.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
So before turning it over to questions, is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'd open it up for questions. Representative Bliss.
Thank you. Just quickly, you know, when I sign my name on the piece of paper, I'm the one putting my name out there. I'm the one getting the scrutiny. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in the room here whose spouse is extremely private. You wouldn't be able to talk politics to her if you tried. She's very, very private, doesn't want any sunlight. She didn't, not that she does anything that needs it, but my concern is that this bill, let me just clarify it. I've read the Associated Businesses, and it says that corporation, partnership, limited liability company, or other legal organized legal entity. Is that, for instance, family trust, where land is left in a trust and they get, you know, distribution from that trust? Is that considered an organized legal entity?
Chair Freiberg, or...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Bliss. Our spouses sound similar. Mine is also a very private person. However, we do also have a shared bank account, and so our finances are pretty well mixed, and there is certainly a potential for conflict, I would say, and it's just, I think, it would be helpful for her, you know, property holdings to be and such to be disclosed. In terms of the specific question about the trust, I would defer to Director Sigurdsson.
Director Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd have to throw back a little bit more information on the trust. Some types of trusts are not covered. However, if it's a property or a trust where property is being held, then I would assume that it would be something that would have to be included. One thing I would point out is that the legislation makes it clear that when the economic interest statement is filled out, there's no designation of, okay, I own this, we own this, and my spouse owns this. It's all just listed, so there wouldn't be any identification of the fact that a particular piece of property or investment was solely in the name of your spouse. It would all be listed, so there wasn't any identification to that point.
Representative Bliss?
Well, I'm a little familiar with family trusts, and in the trusts, the legal document, there is specific trustees listed in that legal document. I don't want to go into too much detail, but not all families keep the same checking account. my life is my life. That sounds bad, but my finances are mine and hers are hers. Except when it comes to my bank account, she seems to be able to. Never mind. I'm sorry. back to the. I mean, her name would be listed on a trust. Mine is not. She's a trustee. I am not. And I guess, and it's minutia, I guess. But I mean, that could possibly, you know, if I'm required to divulge information about my wife's family trust, I don't know. You know, I mean, that doesn't sound right to me. I understand if it's a corporation that she's a chief, you know, member of, and possibly lobbying me to do some finances that way. But I mean, a family trust, I think that should be just exempted, in my opinion. That's all I have. Thank you.
Representative or Chair Freiberg, I didn't hear a question, but do you want to respond? Or do you want me to go? Okay. Any other questions on the bill? Lead Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I think, goes to Mr. Sigurdsson again. This issue of conflict of interest, do these statements of that we submit annually actually define what, are they used to actually define a conflict of interest?
Director Sigurdsson?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I don't know that it defines the conflict of interest. It highlights the potential for a conflict of interest. It's the only documentation that the public has of saying, when this issue comes before the public official and they get to make a decision that's going to result in an expenditure of public funds or perhaps some other decision that regulates an industry, is there any way of knowing that this isn't for their personal benefit? And that's the sole role of the economic interest statement. It's not necessarily to say, well, that person can't serve as a public official. It doesn't do that. It highlights the potential that public official may need to abstain from that particular issue or a vote on that particular issue. But it's the only document that I'm aware of that the public has of knowing that the potential for a conflict of interest is at least being identified, and they understand, it builds trust in the board's view of the actions being taken by public officials, that it's not benefiting them personally.
Lead Torkelson.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. And so then, you know, I haven't had anybody come forward and complain about this situation of the spousal disclosures, but I can imagine that there are individuals who might find it to be a problem. You know, my wife and I got married when each of us had nothing, and we share everything. It's not a problem. But I can imagine someone who, where they got married later in life and they both have substantial assets and they sign a prenuptial agreement because they want to keep their individual assets separate for family reasons or personal reasons. And this requirement to disclose that seems to be going a bit too far in my mind. Any reaction to that, Mr. Sigurdsson?
Mr. Sigurdsson or Chair Freiberg?
The question was directed at Director Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I guess I would answer two things. One, in terms of to my knowledge, of prenuptial agreements that regulates the how property would be split up if the marriage dissolves, it doesn't change the fact that any income earned by, my understanding is that any income earned by property owned strictly by your spouse during your marriage is nonetheless jointly yours. Income earned by property that may be solely the ownership of a spouse is still subject to to the full division that you would expect in a marriage. So there is the possibility, I still believe, that the public official could benefit from property even if it's owned by the spouse. And I'm sorry, I think I may be forgetting part of your question. I think it just goes to also the issue of, does everybody have that sort of prenuptial agreement in place? I mean, in some cases, I think that that's at least an issue where the legislation tries to be sensitive to the idea, and I think the board is sensitive to the idea that we are bringing in individuals in terms of providing disclosure from people who are not public officials. We understand that. And we've tried to build somewhat of a blind so that there's no identification of what's owned by the spouse. But it doesn't change the fact that the board's primary mission here is to provide disclosure that highlights the potential for a conflict of interest. And it, to the board's conclusion is that property owned by a spouse is not going to be ignored, or at least it's very hard for a public official to ignore that potential when they face a decision, or at least it should be aware to the public that that potential exists.
Lead Torkelson, any follow-up?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It gets a little cloudy, it seems to me, as to what I as an individual might benefit from as regard to my spouse or other family members, for that matter. You know, there's lots of family-owned businesses out there where my children might be involved, or if my parents were still alive, they might be involved. And, you know, how far do we take this when it comes to disclosure? It seems that the system we have had in place has worked quite well. I'm not opposed to disclosure when it's appropriate, but on the other hand, people who don't want information disclosed about their finances could be captured in this net. And for reasons that I'm having a little trouble supporting. But thank you for the answers. And what's the path for this bill?
This is being laid over.
So we have the potential to discuss these issues some more. On the other hand, I strongly support the SWCD watershed district portion of this bill. I think it's great.
Thank you, Lee Torkelson. Are there any additional questions on this bill? Seeing no questions, I'll turn it back over to you, Chair Freiberg, for any final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I do appreciate the discussion. You know, this, I think it's important to mention, you know, this isn't prohibiting anyone from having any property or directing anybody to vote a certain way. It's just disclosing potential conflicts. I do believe there's a strong potential there in the case of spousal property. I think it's worth reporting. I'm certainly open to having further discussions. As was mentioned, this is being laid over, but I, you know, just do want to say I think this is a valid valid approach to take.
Chair Freiberg renews the motion that House File 2394 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. This bill is laid over. Chair Freiberg, do you want me to adjourn the meeting?
I'll just mention that we have our next meeting is is not at the normal time. It's Friday, March 17th at 8:30, and it's also not in this room. It'll be in room 5. We are scheduled to go until noon. I don't know that we will need that much time, but out of an abundance of caution, that is what we have scheduled. So just wanted to mention that, and you're certainly welcome to adjourn the meeting.
With that, bring snacks on Friday, and this meeting is adjourned.